You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 497.
It's not the years, honey. It's the mileage. Indiana Jones.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, I have a story for you. Imagine you are a, you know, seven-year-old in 1980 when Raiders of the Lost Ark comes out. And you are blown away by Indiana Jones and the movie and everything. And then you go home and you team up with your friend to make a shot-for-shot recreation of Raiders of the Lost Ark using video technologies that you might have handing around and building sets and setting yourself on fire and building a boulder and the whole ball of wax. And imagine that took 7 years to do it. You do it every summer or so because you can't do it during the school year because it's crazy. And you have no idea about filmmaking. You have no idea about how anything gets done, but you decide to do it. And then years later, that tape surfaces. And by a magical set of coincidences, Steven Spielberg happens to see that movie and calls you into his office to talk Indiana Jones. Well, I just told you the story of Raiders, which is the greatest fan film ever made, which everything I just told you is exactly what happened. Today on the show, we have Eric Zala, who is the director and actor and producer and everything else that needed to be done to get this movie finished. And I wanted to have him on the show because I saw this amazing documentary called Raiders, The Story of the Greatest Fan Film Ever Made. And I've always loved, I mean, I'm a huge Indiana Jones fan and Steven Spielberg fan. And when I saw this, it was just something that you just can't believe that this actually existed. And the story about how it got finished, how it got put together, how the copy of the video got into someone's hands, and then that person got it into Steven Spielberg's hands, and all of the stuff that's happened is pretty remarkable and a dream for a filmmaker. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Eric Zala. I'd like to welcome to the show Eric Zala. How you doing, Eric?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for being on the show, man. I've had a lot of independent filmmakers on the show. I've had big and small, but you have such a unique story about how you made your not only your first film when you were
12. But also, afterwards making being part of another film, documenting the making of the first film. And it's such a unique story. So for everybody, who doesn't know your story, can you talk a little bit about, Raiders of the Lost Ark and what you guys did in a nutshell, because we'll go deep into it.
Sure. So back in 1981, like a lot of kids, loved Raiders Lost Ark, but a lot of kids played Indiana Jones in the backyard. We kind of took it a little bit further. We, from age 12 to 19, 7 summers, we devoted our entire childhood to this wacky idea of doing a shot-for-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Just kids. We had no camera, no clue, no idea what we were doing, no money. Had no idea of what we were getting into. But we stuck with it and managed to finish and have a hometown premiere and sat on our bookshelf for 14 years. And we went off to college in life thinking, finishing all but one scene, the airplane scene, because the airplane blows up.
Sure.
We then were reunited when it was accidentally discovered by Eli Roth, who got a copy to the director of the original.
But wait, stop there for a second. How did he get a copy of it? It's been on your shelf. Like, where did it live in the ether that he could even see a copy of this thing?
Bit of serendipity, Alex. 6 degrees of separation. I went to NYU Film School, and then after graduation, I'm rooming with a fellow alum who made a copy of my film after I showed it to him. He was a working editor, great guy. Passed on to a friend. I was working at Troma in New York.
Nice.
And Fred Raskin got it to Eli Roth, I'm told. And Eli, he grew up doing a shot-for-shot remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and saw our story in this and managed to bring this battered VHS bootleg tape to his own pitch meeting, slid it across the conference room table, and got it to Steven Spielberg, who loved it. And said, I want to write these guys a letter. What's their addresses? And Eli doesn't know. He's never met us. But thankfully, it's 2002 at this point. And so he looks, tracks down one of us through the internet and gets our addresses. We get a letter from Mr. Spielberg thanking us for our very loving and detailed tribute. And then met the man himself about a year later. That's led to a 10,000-word article in Vanity Fair, to our story being told in a book by Alan Eisenstock and St. Martin's Press called Raiders, the Story of the Greatest Fan Film Ever Made. And then we decided to reunite the cast after 25 years and do the one scene that we couldn't do as kids, the airplane scene. A documentary crew followed us in doing that. So now there's a documentary about these wacky Mississippi kids doing the shot-for-shot remake of Raiders Lost Ark in the 80s. So I keep expecting to close the book on this Raiders thing, and it keeps
popping up. It keeps popping up. So I have to ask, okay, so let's take it back for a minute. So it's 1981. Like we were talking before we got on the air, we're of similar vintage. You're a few years ahead of me. I remember 81, 82, because that's when VHS's and video stores, at least where I lived in New York, started to show up.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure if Raiders was out yet, because it was such a new thing that they didn't want to release it. So how could you even conceive of doing a shot from memory?
Great question. Yeah. So Raiders, of course, came out in summer of 81. We got the idea in 82. Thankfully, they used to do theatrical re-releases of really popular films.
Sure,
so
sure.
Raiders came out at this time. And you're right, video stores were around, but they were in their infancy, and you could not yet rent Raiders. So after Chris and I decided to embark on this endeavor, we snuck in a audio tape cassette recorder into the movie theater playing Raiders to to surreptitiously record the soundtrack. The thinking as naive and foolish as we were. We were 12. Right. Was that we're going to use capture the sound effects. Oh, yeah. And no concept of like,
you know, editing, sound recording, editing, quality.
We were fumbling around in the dark on how to do it. But the idea was that it did wind up being helpful.
I'm sure.
Even though, you know, the cheers were visible, you could hear it. It sounded terrible. But what I did was I used it as a memory jog later on. I got Raiders, the storybook, Raiders, the movie on record, Raiders, you know, the trading cards, everything Raiders like allowance could support, and cobbled it all together and spread it all across a dining room table. And I spent a whole summer, drawing the storyboards from memory using my visual memory jogs and the soundtrack. And it took me a whole summer, 602 storyboards in all, but finished. Jesus. And I finally felt like I'd lived in that world for a while, and I think it prepared me for directing. We wouldn't shoot until the following summer, but it provided a homemade blueprint for the film.
That's absolutely ridiculous and amazing all at the same time.
And of course, a mere year or two after that, Raiders comes out at your local Blockbuster, and we're like, we can watch it.
And just watch it. And literally then at that point you could finally – and Blockbuster wasn't around yet. So it was probably your mom and pop in 83 because Blockbuster hadn't come around. Just – I used to work at a video store. So this is why I know these things. So it was like your mom and pop, and it was – you couldn't purchase it because purchasing it at that time would cost you – I don't think it didn't come out through sell-through. Yeah. Not yet. So it was still $125 to buy it, if I remember correctly.
It was an insane pricing scheme. They hadn't figured it out yet.
Yeah, it was –
Her Alibi, the Tom Selleck movie, for $50. I mean, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was insane until I think E.T. didn't come out until like 87, 88. I think E.T. came out, and that was the first big sell-through other than Disney. Disney's were going at $24.99 for a while, but the big studios hadn't got it, and E.T. showed up, and then everyone was like, wait a minute. We can make money with this VHS stuff. And then everything, everything became sell-through. And then, so you had it. You had it and you would rent it. So you would rent it and then watch it, rent it and watch it.
Well,
Or dubbed it.
Well, Chris, when Chris's mom remarried the owner of the local TV station, Chris was in a rich house, so they could afford a laser disc.
Very nice.
So we studied it like.
And then you could do frame.
Scholars.
Yeah, you know, you could frame by frame that. Yeah.
The Dead Sea Scrolls, exactly. and I mean, to this day, every note of the soundtrack, every line of dialogue is permanently, indelibly etched in my brain. You know, and of course, I tried to like commit as much to memory in that theater in 82. As it turns out, my storyboards were pretty accurate. There were a couple compositions flip, but for the most part, a fairly fateful rendition.
Now, when you watched Raiders for the first time, I want people to understand this who might be younger or didn't have the opportunity to watch Raiders when it came out in the theaters. What was that magical thing that when you saw it, I've had so many big guests on the show, and Raiders always pops up as their top three in their top three. It's like one of those films that's just like, change cinema. And then Spielberg just was changing cinema. Like almost every picture he made was changing cinema. But Raiders was just like, what did it do for you? How did it connect to you in that way that caused you to do this?
I do remember this. It was, I saw it in Ocean Spring Cinema with a buddy of mine. I actually wasn't looking forward to seeing it that much, you know, like many is like, why cowboy chasing after Noah's Ark?
What is this thing?
All right. Critics seem to like it.
Right.
And, you know, the dark, you know, we see the man with the hat moving through the forest. By the time we get to the boulder scene and I see the boulder barreling down on Indy, I split my brain open. I did not know that movies could do that, that they could be that exciting. I mean, I love Star Wars, but, you know, grounded in our own reality. set in a time when Raiders, you know, the 30s, pockets of mystery still existed throughout the world. It, I think maybe that's why it resonated, especially. But what a thrill ride! What an utter roller coaster! And I wanted to, in some way, inhabit that world. And so when Chris later on, you know, about half a year later, looks me up in the white pages and calls me and says, "Hey, I'm that kid from the bus. I'm doing a shot-for-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Do you want to help?" I thought for all of 5 seconds, you know, imagining that all the sets were built and I just kind of walk on and help. But the movie was so amazing. I think had Chris chosen Smokey and the Bandit, as great as that Burt Reynolds flick is, I don't think it would have endured because, yeah, it lit the fire, you know. I think it was the, you know, if I had to pinpoint it, it was the boulder scene. That mm-hmm. and the truck scene that just absolutely captivated me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Movies would never be the same after that. How could they be? It was lightning in a bottle.
I remember they released the making of Raiders of the Lost Ark on VHS. And on the there was a two-parter. It was a two-parter. And the second part was like the history of stuntmen. Yeah, great movie stuff. Like the history of stuntmen or something like that. And I've had that.
Oh, well.
I watched that because and for everyone listening, you have to understand, in the 80s, there was no information about making movies anywhere. True. Other than some making of books or the occasional like Star Wars making of or Raiders making of. And then in VHS, like that wasn't – there was no DVD special extras. There was laser discs.
Exactly.
Criterion Collection. That's when I caught all that, the extra stuff.
If you were a real geek – you would subscribe maybe to Starlog or got the
or Cine or Cine or Cine or Cine whatever what is it called not, yeah but one of those yeah the VFX book yeah all of those yeah Starlog or those kind of things that's super geeky. I never got to that geek. I didn't know
Me
it
either,
existed
actually.
I didn't know it existed or else I would have ordered it. I was in I was in like Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I was like there's nothing even remotely close to filmmaking anything. Yeah, so I was like not in that world at all. But yeah, so everybody understanding, like that's why I could pinpoint that making of and the making of Dracula, Coppola's Dracula. Those two making ofs changed, like it really changed the way I looked at filmmaking.
I held up my same audio tape cassette recorder to the TV when it came on, when the making of came on PBS.
Yeah.
Remember that song? Memories, Friends, and 8x10s.
Yes.
You remember.
Yes, I do. Wow, we're
available.
Eric, we're old. Eric, we are old. We are old, sir. So, all right, but I have to ask you. So, I mean, obviously you're 12, 13, you guys. You obviously don't have a plan with this. This is just a crazy fan. This is before fan films.
Before they were well known. We can't claim to be the first. But certainly pre-internet, as far as we knew, we were the only ones in the world doing this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was in 88, 89, my coworker at the video store was doing Back to the Future 2 fan films, like with the hoverboard and everything. I remember him making those things. So they were always there, especially because the VHS or the high eight cameras were out and you could shoot. You shot with this with high eight, right?
Betamax originally and then VHS.
And then VHS. So yeah, you just jumped right into both. Jesus, man, that's amazing. So you had no end game to this. So you were just doing it for the fun of it. You didn't think you were going to make money with this.
We had no more ambitious goal than to just finish the damn thing. And that, as simple as it is, seemed after like 5 years in, you really start to wonder.
Well, I mean, listen, you guys kept going like – and it was this summers, like 7 summers, and you kept going, and you would go through the year, and I'm assuming there was some planning, and like, hey, I can go get this, or I can go that. That you guys kept this up for 7 years at that age, where between 12 and whatever 19,
change a little bit.
Yeah, change a bit. Your things that were cool at 12 aren't cool at 19 at any strain. So that you kept this all going really serves. As a testament to the love of Raiders and of Indy and everything that they did. And what Steven and George put together with, with the story. And even to this day, I mean, right now, as we're talking, Harrison's doing another indie. I believe it's his last one. I think he just got hurt on this one. Like, Harrison, I know you want a paycheck, but it's you're 80. But you know what? You earn the right to do whatever the hell you want. So knock yourself out. But all right. So what was the toughest part of making this thing?
I think, you know, it is ultimately the battle of the spirit. You know, as challenging as the logistics of, you know, how are we going to make the boulder? You know, how are we going to find a suitable location for the Sahara Desert on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, you know, in the 80s? You know, there's those challenges. But, you know, since your question is what's the hardest part, it's that, you know, battle of the spirit thing.
You mean keeping going or just
keeping going? Exactly. And pushing through those moments of doubt, you know, where, you know, 7 years, that's a long time. That's plenty of time, opportunity for conflict, for, as you say, disillusionment or whatnot, or other interests. People, you know, there's process and then there's people. Film, as you well know, is the collaborative art, right? You and you can create something together bigger and more spectacular than you could by yourself. But the rub is it's also can be the greatest source of stress and conflict. And that was the case in our journey, too.
Ego. Don't forget ego.
Right. You know, we nearly split up over a girl, and then there was conflict near the end on how much work to give the sound in the editing room, which split us up near as we were almost over the finish line.
This is when you're still kids or towards?
Towards the end at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I started my first year at NYU Film School, the film Undone and Us Not Talking to Each Other, truly and utterly done with each other. But we met it. Things came together. That's the toughest part, I think.
Especially when you're doing indies at this point, it's not even an indie. It's a fan film. It's definitely an indie film, meaning independent, but not in any traditional definition because you can't make money with it. There's no investors, none of that stuff. But anytime you're doing things at that level, you're dealing with amateurs. I mean, you guys literally were amateurs. You're all 12-year-olds with a camera and stuff. So you're still figuring out who the hell you are, let alone trying to build art together. But the only thing that held this whole thing together was the love of Indiana.
That, you know, and one thing that also worked, you know, one strength of collaboration is the sense of inter-accountability, you know.
Yeah.
All right, you know, my buddies are working on this, you know, can't give up. I think that helped, you know, kind of keep the cast and the crew, you know, the core together throughout all those years. That and some luck, you know, like when I approached Pretty Girl after church in the parish hall and said, hey, my buddies and I are making a movie. Do you want to be in it? You know, we didn't know many girls.
You needed a Marion.
So we would have been sunk had she said no. So she said yes, having no idea she was making a multi-year commitment. But there too, lucky.
There's no question. And also, I read somewhere that this was kind of like a DIY filmmaking boyhood because you guys grow up on screen. So like how did you even think, like, and it's, I'm assuming you shot out of, did you shoot in sequence or out of sequence? I don't remember.
Completely out of sequence.
Right. So you like one moment you're 12, one moment you're 17. Like, that's amazing.
It is true. When we started shooting to simulate Indy's trademark stubble, Chris got Vaseline and ash from the fireplace and, you know, smeared it on his, and by the end,
yeah, it's double.
He just skipped it, shaving for a day, you know. It's true. There's one part in our college scene in which we cut away to a cutaway taken 3 years later after Chris's voice broke. And it's kind of obvious.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Now, I did see in the film, I mean, you guys did some fairly dangerous stuff. What is the most dangerous thing that you guys did that, looking back as a grown man today, would go, oh my God, if my kids were down there doing that, I would lose my mind?
Yes. And it's the only solemn moment when I give Q&As after screenings is to, you know, for all the young people in the audience.
Don't do this.
You know, whatever you take from this, don't set yourselves on fire. Don't, you know, please be safe. We're young. We're dumb. We could have very easily been killed.
And it was there. The 80s. And it was the 80s. And in the 80s, how we survived the 80s is a general statement as human beings, because the safety protocols, the stuff that we're being fed.
Exactly.
We could survive anything.
It's been observed that our movie probably couldn't be made today, and that's probably one aspect. You're right. Yeah, you know, from being there, it was the, you know, the wild 80s where you don't have an understanding of the basic fragility of the human body yet.
So basically, just for everyone listening, when you are in an airplane, the smoking section was parted by a drape. So they thought that the drape would stop the smoke from circulating inside of the cylinder tube that's flying up in the air. This is what you had to deal with as a – babies were there. Babies. I mean, you could be smoking next to a baby. It didn't matter.
Right. Yeah. That was a different time. That's for sure. But to answer your question, I mean, there's so many. I mean, probably setting myself on fire – it ranks even higher than duct taping Roman candles to my arms and shooting them out of my arms to simulate the power of God.
Sure.
Through the Ark of the Covenant, shooting through my
body,
my character, oh, Belloc, at the end. Even more than the Roman candles. Yeah. You see, I stunt double for the character of the Ratty Nepalese. There was a neighborhood kid doing it, but I wasn't going to ask some kid to do that. So I thought, I'll do it. And plus, I know the blocking. So my costume was this, I think, Chris's grandmother's shawl that we like stole out of the closet. We raided parents' closets. Underneath it, a fire retardant raincoat. You know, safety first. And we were in this... We're shooting the Nepalese saloon in the basement underneath the kitchen. And we're, for the most part, using isopropyl alcohol bought from the local Kmart. But for whatever reason that day, I asked the guys to douse my back with gasoline, thinking it would...
Not gasoline, not lighter gasoline. Fluid.
I'm embarrassed to say.
Gasoline. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
high octane, at least? Was it good octane? Was that premium? Okay.
So
continue.
So I take my mark and call action and stand and hit my mark and scream and the kid with a lit torch just out of frame rushes forth and lights me and phoom, I go up and I feel the flame. It feels like an electric blanket on my back been turned up high. That's the best. But the guys are supposed to run forth with a smothering blanket. Finally, they do, and the neighborhood kid throws it on my back, and he's eager to see if he's successful. So he pulls it off, sees, oh, Eric's still on fire. Back on, off, on, fanning the flames higher. Meanwhile, the small basement room is filled with the stench of burnt hair. It's flyers that's starting to lick the back of my hair and catch. Chris, meanwhile, in the foreground, there's this kid with the fire extinguisher, our plan B, reading the instructions, pull, pin, I'm still on fire. Chris grabs the smothering blanket, runs forward and knocks me down and push in, smothers
you.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. The real heat came later when
your parents found
the
out.
Moms spotted me with my back on fire, and for some reason I had a problem with this.
Right. Yeah.
They're like, we're shut down for the rest of the summer, told no more fire. Chris's mom suggested, why can't Indy just hit the bad guy with a big sack of leaves? Big sack of leaves? Mom, you don't understand. Anyway, the following summer, things had cooled off, metaphorically speaking, and I had a plan to sell the moms on approving continued fire. Two words, adult chaperone, found an adult even less responsible than we were. Peter Kiefer, God love him, who drank beer and gave us good instruction on where to put the fire.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So the pyrotechnics continued unabated.
No one got hurt.
And amazingly, I can show you a piece of charred wire that I was given by my parents years later. Turns out we had no idea how lucky we were. The heat from that day was so bad that it melted the plastic insulation off the wires running along the ceiling beams, exposing the bare copper wire. Years later, the house could have gone up like that through an electrical short. Again, so very lucky.
Oh my God.
So yeah, that was probably that more than anything. I wince. It is not the closest I came to death, but it is probably the most dangerous.
Which brings me to my next question. stunts. Indy is known for stunts. It's considered one of the greatest stunt movies. Of what they did is legendary. They did a whole movie behind the scenes of it, all that kind. The truck scene and the boulder scene. And I actually went to, is it Disney MGM Studios in Florida, where they have the Indy Adventure. And I was called up to be one of the participants. I was lucky one. I was when I went to college, and I got called up, and I was part of the behind the scenes of all that. It was the most exciting, and I was like one of the villagers or whatever. I was like, and they you see everything from. Oh, it was amazing! It was so awesome.
That sounds great.
So you have all of this these stunts. How do you approach some of the greatest stunts in movie history when you're 12, 13, 14, 15?
Well, that depends on, yeah, when you're 12, you know, like, as I said, it's just, well, okay, it's time to drag behind the truck. So, all right, let's drag behind the truck. Chris, when he did that stunt, elbow pads and knee pads underneath.
Safety first.
actually going underneath and leaping off of moving vehicles driven by kids who may or may not have had their driver's permit at the time. Big contrast with later, which, you know, in doing the airplane scene, the only the top budget item was hiring a pyrotechnic expert so it would be safe. We told our wives, you know, all right, we're going to do this right. $25,000 to make sure that is done right. It was like
That's a big explosion.
Raised on Kickstarter.
Yeah, it's a big explosion and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I get that. Yeah,
but so you know, what could go wrong? And of course, if seeing the documentary, you know that best laid plans. It's something that. You know, back then, we did our best to be careful, but I can't believe on how lucky we were. We built the truck was this abandoned truck, and we built all these safety things onto it, like jutting from the front of the hood was this big wooden scoop that would catch Indy when he's thrown through the and the sergeant, which we used.
Right.
Of course, it's still not probably as safe as it could be, but we tried, and nobody was hurt. Amazingly, during the entire 7 years, we had some close calls. Ironically, Chris was Indiana Jones, did his own stunts, as noted. I was the director and played Belloc, but I was the one who kept getting hurt. The closest stuff. I broke my arm at one point. I nearly got burnt up, hair singed, and of course the plaster event, which you know from the documentary.
Can you tell people about the plaster event?
Sure. So my character, of course, is Belloc, and Of course, everyone knows at the end of Raiders, no spoiler, real spoilers here.
Yeah, if you like at this point, if you don't know what Raiders, that's not us. It's not on us.
Exactly. Well, my character doesn't melt. My character blows up. So we're going to do the three imploding, exploding, and melting heads the same way that Spielberg and makeup man Chris Wallace did it. Make a gelatin mold of the actor's plaster mold of the actor's head, fill it with gelatin, paint it flesh colored, and when it comes time to shoot it, get a heat gun, which is like a super hair dryer, turn it on, melt in the case of Tote, or in my case, blow it up. That's the plan. I volunteer to go first. So Jason has done research on how to make a plaster mold. So we're on the back porch of my mom's house in Mississippi. Chris, Jason, and I, and my little brother Kurt mix up this concoction. I've got a shower cap on my head, two cut straws stuffed up my nose, and a pear wedged in my mouth so I can breathe and hold the screaming position, you know, because Belloc's
of course
screaming. For the requisite 20 minutes it's going to take for the plaster to harden. World disappears from view as they lop it on my head and it cools, it dries. And all of a sudden I feel this tremendous building heat.
Yeah.
Almost like someone stuck my head in an oven. So Jay, come to find out, made a small error. It's supposed to get dental plaster instead.
He got real plaster.
Industrial plaster,
heating
agent, yeah, to speed the drying. So it felt like my head was being baked. The guys told me it was too hot to touch at the time. It's like, must have been nice to choose. But I felt like, all right, pain is temporary, film is forever.
This insanity of filmmakers.
it cools and you know, 3 inches thick, it's hard as concrete. It's ready to pry off my face. So the guys reach around to pry the husk off my head, and all of a sudden I'm in this excruciating pain around my eyes and eyelids. Turns out Jason made a second mistake that day. You always want to put Vaseline on the eyelashes and eyebrows. Jay didn't do that, and mine were embedded in the plaster, and they were not coming out for anything. Compounding this problem, I have no way of telling Chris or Jason any of this. You know, just, what, Eric, what's wrong? I make a motion and, you know, do this. I think it's Chris, and they figure it out. So they get this hammer and chisel. All right, Eric, lean back. Managed to break a hole in. And not drive the screwdriver into my eye socket and into my brain, thankfully.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know. Cool air rushes in at that point around my nose. I know I'm not going to suffocate, but it's still not coming off. So I make a motion for a pad and paper, and I write, hospital. And so they call 911. My mom's in the front of the house. She has no idea any of this is going on, but she sees a squad car pulling into the driveway. I hear this cop, damn, boy, what you got on your head? I feel myself being helped in the backseat of my mom's car and driven a distance to the emergency room where they take this saw that they used to buzz casts off with.
Yeah.
Take all of it off except for a little area around my eyes. And for that, surgeon comes in and takes a scalpel and saws away at the infinitesimally small space between my eyelids and eyebrows. And I had no eyelashes, half one eyebrow, and was missing the other. And, you know, borrowed my mom's eyebrow pencil, fill it in before returning to high school. They've grown back now.
Obviously. They look fantastic, sir. They look fantastic. They look fantastic now. I as I'm hearing these stories, I've said this many times, what we have is a disease. Filmmaking is a disease. It is an absolute disease. It is something that once you get bitten by that bug, it is yours for life. You can't get rid of it. There's no vaccination for it. It can go dormant for decades, but it will always rear its ugly head at one point, ugly or beautiful head, depending how you look at it.
Sure.
But that is insane. And I'm thinking of myself, like, and I'm thinking in the back of my head, like, where are their parents? And then I'm thinking to myself, my parents would have been the exact same thing. It was a different time. It's a different time. It's just, they would be like, oh yeah, the kids are out there. Like, I mean, we used to like go, you know, in the morning we'd leave all day. And then when the lights came on, off, the headlights or the street lights went on, got to be back in the house.
Exactly.
And that was it. There was no cell phones. There's no way of computing. You had no idea where your child was. I can't even comprehend that with my kids.
Exactly. I'm a parent now myself.
Right.
And mom set the bar high that way. But how do you recreate that? I struggle now because I want that same freedom, that same glorious freedom that you it's easy to wax nostalgic and poetic about it because I'm so grateful for it. Sounds like you are too.
Oh, it was a wonderful, I love the time that I grew up, and I love the 80s always hold a very special time in my life because that's when, you know, was when I discovered movies, and it was just a very unique time in life. Wow. Kind of the way like Tarantino looks at the late 60s and 70s, I look at the 80s. Because I love all about the movies, and now I get to talk to the filmmakers of that time, which is like, you know, just geek out about.
Sure, so
What was it like, you know, writing this movie? Spielberg. I have to ask you, man. What was it like? Like, tell me the whole story. I'm assuming you met him. Did you meet him in Amblin and Universal?
Right? Yes.
So the whole story, like, when you did you take the golf cart up, or did you part? Like, I want the we want to hear this story. Sure. We want to live through it.
So. So we after getting the letter, which my wife photographed me in various stages of opening, you know, thinking, my God, it can't possibly get any better than this. Spielberg likes, you know, this film that we did. Unbelievable. Jump to about a year later. Chris and I are in Los Angeles. We're in town. The Vanity Fair article has just come out. And we actually have an agent who gives us a call and says, hey, Spielberg wants to meet you tomorrow at noon at Amblin on the Universal lot. I'm like,
right. What?
It's almost too much. But can you imagine? So the next day, of course, we're there and we drive up and first through on the Universal lot and then back to Amblin. And, you know, the big gates part, we drive through to this compound, sort of Santa Fe, southeastern architecture. You know it, yeah.
Yeah,
well, we go in, and I say to the receptionist the most absurd words I've ever uttered in my life. Hi, we're here to see Steven Spielberg, and have it not be a joke.
Right.
You can wait over there. So we sit. They usher us in. We walk up through a courtyard upstairs to wait in a conference room. And we're drumming our fingers on the conference room table, Chris, Jason, and I, waiting, seeing these honorary degrees on the wall for Spielberg. And behind the door approaching, we hear that familiar voice. You've seen The Making of Raiders Lost Ark. You know that voice. It's the man himself. And door flings open. Hey, boys. And in walks Steven Spielberg, the man himself. And he calls us boys, I remember. We're like 30-something at this point, but we're the...
You're boys.
Certainly feeling like it.
Absolutely.
So we sit, and I'm sitting, Spielberg, Chris, me, Jason, and talking. We talked about 45 minutes about movies, about Raiders, about life. He gave us really great advice. He said, pick a great story and tell it really well. That was, I mean, it's simple, but back to basics. That's that. And he talked about what he went through in Raiders. I had lots of questions, one of which was, you know, the box set had just come out, and I was hoping that certain deleted scenes that I'd read about and, you know, in what research we could do, as you know, sure, back in the day. And I knew that there were, you know, Indy tied to the Periscope, Salinger getting shot by the German soldier. And I lament that, wish could have seen those. And he said, well, I've got those, the outtakes on a tape in my office. Do you want to see? I'm like, yeah. So 5 minutes later, sitting on a couch in Spielberg's office, watching the outtakes from Raiders and Temple of Doom with a sense that we're seeing something that only the crew had seen. It was the most surreal, amazing thing. After that, he even granted our request for a photo, and then we stumbled out into the sunlight. What just happened? I'll never forget that day.
I'm sure. Look, it's kind of like I always tell people, you know, this Spielberg is like, or Steven is like, he lives on Mount Hollywood. He's one of the gods. He's Zeus, if you will. And we're just mortals. And then every once in a while he comes down and he's like, you can come visit, or he'll touch you and go, you shall direct, or you shall write. And he has that power to do that. And, you know, I've been blessed to talk to so many amazing filmmakers on my show. It never surprises me the amount of people he has touched behind the scenes. People who have no direct public relationship with him out front, but he's like, yeah, you know, I was Steven's the one who got me that meeting with Clint. And then that's how I got my first writing job. And then fast forward later, I won the Oscar. Like things like that. And you're just like, it's amazing. And I hear his name again and again and again. And he's one of the most, from my understanding, one of the most giving people in the business and one of the most generous people in the business. He helped so many careers and continues to help so many careers get off the ground. It is remarkable. And it doesn't surprise me at all he would do something like that with you guys, busy as he is.
Certainly fortunate, and you're right. I mean, being a movie lover as I am, of course, I've read about all my heroes. And Spielberg proves nice guys don't finish last, you know. Right. He's a good person, you know. And like you said, the impact of his touching people, inspiring people, taking the time to write. Still blows my mind that he sent Chris, Jason, and I those letters. And others, too. I love many directors, but I feel like he's our greatest living director right now, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been any filmmaker in the history of our business that has done what he has done. There's other great artists, there's other great filmmakers, Scorsese and Kubrick. Absolutely. And Kurosawa and a million other amazing and living too, like Nolan and Fincher and all these brothers. The Coen brothers. I mean, the list goes on. There's no lack of amazing filmmakers, but his ability to not only change film history multiple times, he changed film history from Jaws, creating the blockbuster, to Close Encounters, to Raiders, then to E.T. And then, I had the pleasure of having Jim Hart on, who wrote Hook. And I remember in 91, I was working at the video store, I was in high school, and the rumors of like, oh, you know, Spielberg's washed up. You know, he hasn't had a hit in a while. And, you know, he's not what he was before. I think it's over for Steven. And I remember that, you know, in the media, people would do that. That chatter, and I'm like, it's Steven Spielberg. No,
count him out.
And I love Hook, by the way. I absolutely adore Hook, but it wasn't as successful as they all wanted it to be. Then he comes out 2 years later and has the biggest movie of all time and wins every single Oscar with Schindler's List and Jurassic Park, and just cements himself as like, just oh, and also changes cinema forever with Jurassic Park,
right?
Because it brings in digital filmmaking, which now is just filmmaking. Oh, and also made a black and white movie about the Holocaust that also was very successful financially. Like, it's insanity what he did.
Right, right. You shouldn't be able to do that. And yet he pulled it off.
In 1 year release.
Yeah. And I can't imagine what it would be like to shoot Schindler's List while editing Jurassic Park. Can you?
With visual effects that have never been created before.
Right, right. It's like, I'm a Kubrick fan. I love how he had special lenses created for shots.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's so many other things, but Spielberg, like you said, before he pioneered CGI, which of course is now the thing, of course, Jaws was the original blockbuster, right?
E.T.?
Yeah. I mean, going back and repeat viewing movies, it's can't underestimate the impact of that. So I can't believe that we, while I wish that he were directing Indy 5, James Mangold, you know, he's an awesome director. Mm-hmm. We're in good hands, but I count myself lucky. We've got another indie film coming out, and there's Spielberg films coming out still.
Yeah, that's West Side Story coming out this fall. And if there's anyone who could tackle West Side Story, it's Steven Spielberg, which is one of his favorite movies of all time. Like, how do you remake West Side Story? But it's Steven Spielberg. You do whatever, you know. It's just, there's very few filmmakers out there that you could just trust that whatever they're going to do is going to be at a level that, I mean, and his movies have changed a lot since the 80s because he's matured as a filmmaker. So he's, you know, now we get a much more mature Steven, as opposed to him being whimsical and the Poltergeists and that
kind. Matured. Yeah.
The voice has matured without question, but that's why I loved Ready Player One. It was kind of like a heart back to that, which was...
Yes. I know what you mean. It did have that effect. I remember being asked about Spielberg, and I think I can most sum it up by saying it's amazing thing to meet your childhood hero, but it's also great to discover that you've chosen your heroes well, you know.
And can you imagine for Steven, every day of his life, he does what he did for you guys with somebody, whether it be a crew member that he's working with, a collaborator, someone on the street. Every day of his life, he's meeting someone who his world changed somebody else's world. Like, he made E.T. That was the very first time I ever thought of being a filmmaker. Before I even knew what a filmmaker was, I saw E.T., I walked out and I wrote my first screenplay, which was about five sentences long, and it was basically a boy befriends an alien. And that was the end of my story. But it was the
first... Still inspired you.
But it was the first time that thought ever crossed my mind. And he's done that for tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people around the world. I mean, he is, you know, it's a love fest right now with Steven, but it's true. And he deserved, and not only the movies he's directed, but the movies he's produced, Back to the Future and all these, and the shows he's done. And there's just nobody ever. I mean, I can't pinpoint any director, producer in history who's had the impact on the world as much as Steven Spielberg. I'm
with you. It's a tough one. I mean, and Lucas, of course, well, obviously he is, you know, the brain that invented Star Wars and Indiana Jones, amazing too. And I think maybe that alchemy of Lucas and Spielberg coming together, that perfect thing, those two bearded men on the beach that day, you know?
I mean, and Lucas is a whole other conversation, but George, I mean, Star Wars has impacted so many people, but he did it with basically one or two or three things, where Spielberg, it's just all the time with so many different films, so many different stories, so many different genres and television and movies, and also how many other filmmakers he helped push out. There's nobody like him ever.
In my own journeys, the people that I've crossed paths with along the way who are like, have a share that love, they've shown me a letter with that stationery that I recognize with Steven Spielberg Russell. It's like, he inspired me too. He wrote me too. So I actually,
he's amazing
independently. So it's amazing. Fully deserving of all the commercial and creative success he's had.
Amen, brother. Amen. Now, one thing I wanted to talk to you about was the documentary. And now that it seems like you have a very filmtrepreneurial approach to selling the documentary and the movie and all this kind of stuff, which is unusual for a fan film. Fan films generally don't have the freedom to do things like this, you like, because they're afraid and there's been stories about it and all that kind of stuff. Especially, I think that Star Trek movie raised like $1 million. And at that point, Paramount was like, oh, okay, guys, let's calm the hell down. We need to calm down.
Right,
But you've gotten kind of a pass, whether it be unofficial or official, you've gotten a pass. But I do, as far as copyright and all that kind of stuff, but I do think that, you know, you're definitely not taking anybody away from Steven Spielberg or Paramount at that point. You have anything you're helping. But how did you approach the whole, you know, entrepreneurial aspect of things? Because you're selling different products and you've got a book and you've got this and that.
Well, it wasn't like the success of the film itself. We never could have imagined that. And that's something that is only a fairly recent development. Obviously, back when we were 12, we certainly weren't thinking about copyright. And we had no greater ambition than to just finish it.
And show it to your friends.
Enough goal.
And just to show it to your friends and your family, basically.
Exactly. You know, when 25 years after we finished, we decided, you know, there we were approached, you know, to have a book about our story. We said yes, you know, and it's a warts and all, you know, weren't interested in a fluff piece. So we wanted, we opened up to the author, Alan Eisenstock. He did an amazing job. And people tracking us down and inviting us to screen around the world, from Sydney, Australia to Sitka, Alaska. Chris and I toured for about 13 years, if you can imagine, screening at over hundreds of screenings.
Wow.
Just because we were working on a screenplay at the time, but it was really inspiring to see, you know, the folks, but we weren't selling it. Then we documentary rolls around. We do the airplane scene. We raise $58,000 on Kickstarter to complete the airplane scene because, you know, all right, well, we don't have the excuse of being kids. We got to deliver was kind of my ethos. The right. ethos was always have it be as cool as we can get it. So we complete it and we make good on Kickstarter and send out thousands of copies. And after that, you know, to in an effort to pay down the $17,000 that I personally put into the airplane scene, we started began a website in order to keep in touch with folks after that. And folks kept saying, need to get love to get a copy. So we made it available on the website. And I think we seem to be operating under the good graces of Lucasfilm and Spielberg and all, who, as Spielberg termed it, are very loving and detailed tribute. I think if I had to surmise, while there's never been a formal conversation about it, I think perhaps they recognize that if anything, we help put money in the coffers of the copyrights holders. If anything, back when we toured, video stores would rent out all copies of Raiders for weeks before and after, I'm told. When we're in Omaha, Nebraska, actually during the Raiders tour, where there's this spectacular lobby display, recreation of the Emperor's chair and the Death Star, and also without official approval. And the manager told me a story. Someone from Lucasfilm came out to check it out and said, "All right, good job, you're good." Interestingly, the concern to me, okay, if you're going, you know, if you're going to do an homage to our copyright,
better be good.
Do it well. And the fact that maybe we work so hard on it and perhaps it's good and hopefully does right by it, I'd like to think that it may play into the fact that they've allowed us to continue as we have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's remarkable. And you get it. That's the one thing we didn't talk about. You guys went back and finished this thing. And you raised, like, you spent close to $100,000 or something like that on it. I mean, how was that going back and with Chris? Because I know you guys had a falling out, and you know, and, you know, I understand that completely because I had similar issues early on in my career with a good friend. And you know, you learn as you get older, you're like, it's ego or it's this or that and whatever. But how was that like getting back together and then like, hey, we're going to shoot this scene.
You know, documentary guys, they decided to do a documentary and Chris resurrected the idea of doing the airplane scene. We were asked in Q&As when we were touring before, hey, you know, we used to joke, hey, we should do this ride and get the cast back together and do this. You think anybody noticed the age difference? Ha ha ha. But I dismissed the idea because I didn't want people to think, okay, well, you know, people don't know I'm an award-winning filmmaker apart from Raiders. If we do this airplane scene, all people are going to think is that we can do is do Raiders. And then, of course, Jason in the documentary, articulates, you know, my worst fear exactly. But for that reason, I said no initially. And my wife reminded me at the time, back when we were kids, we weren't really concerned with what the world thought. You know, we just did this for ourselves because we needed to do it. And that was enough. And good things come from that when you operate from a place of passion. And so I said, all right, yeah, let's do it. And I can't do, you know, anything half-assed. So we're decided no cardboard plane shot on VHS. We're not going to be cutesy. Same ethos as before. Raised $58,000. And reunite the cast. And everyone says yes, even Angela, who's are married. She's living in Minnesota now. Kurt, my little brother, reprises his role of Gobler. I wound up getting up. I'm working full time in Las Vegas at this time. And sure, it would have been makes sense to shoot a desert airfield in the desert. But we wanted to be true kind of to the spirit. So we decided to shoot it back in Mississippi, where we shot this back in the day as kids. Logistically challenging since I live in Vegas. I get up at 3:30 in the morning to get in some time each day to work on it. Chris flies down and we're doing logistics, early morning phone calls. And the process, it is in some ways similar and different. The nice thing now, back when we were kids, you know, I was like painting hieroglyphics on my mom's basement wall on Friday nights while my peers were having keggers, you know, thinking, am I a loser? But now as adults, we've got the entire town has kind of come out to support free hotel room, you know, free food, people donating to become part of the story. It's overwhelming. So we have more resource and support than we ever had before. But gone are the days of endless summer, right? I've got 5 days during the slowest time and bracketed by 2 weekends, 9 days to do 128 shots. All right, and it's an immovable thing. So that is that was different and presented a new challenge. Counterbalancing the greater resource is higher pressure, less time. Lot more at stake. We did manage to finish. One thing that didn't change is, you know, that we talked about Battle of a Spirit, you know, is really what it comes down to. And mm-hmm. at the heart of that is that inner voice that of doubt that says, you know what, you're never going to finish, or it's not going to be good.
Right.
Plane's going to be rusted away in this mud pit. We'll call it Zayla's Folly, you know, for generations to come around your hometown. What if you fail? That always was a consistent, and you just have to keep on pushing that aside. That's kind of my takeaway from doing it then and now.
What is the biggest lesson you learned during this whole thing, man? This whole journey from 12 to now, you've gone through all of this experience. It's a very unique experience. Not many other filmmakers have ever had this. Actually, no other filmmakers has ever had this. So you have this wonderful journey, which is full of pains and ups and downs and excitement and pitfalls and all this, come very much like an Indiana Jones film. What's the biggest thing you learned?
If I had to distill it down to one thing, in two words, always finish. Always finish. There were so many times, especially as kids, where you're sorely tempted to give up on the project, on each other. You just have to hold on and push through when it's not fun, when it's not, you know, for me, that wasn't the issue, but there were other things. There's always those challenges. Push through that and finish. And like I said, we almost didn't finish over a editing room mutiny on how much work to give the sound at the end. But if we had not finished, we wouldn't be talking right now, would we? I wouldn't have that wonderful letter from my childhood hero up on my wall. I wouldn't have had this amazing journey. It'd just be a box of videotapes in somebody's basement. And that'd be the saddest thing of all. So always finish, you know, despite it's painful, even though you may not want to do it in the moment anymore. The act of completion is valuable immeasurably for, I think, for many things. So that's the one bit of advice I give young filmmakers when they ask me after screenings. Always finish.
And I think to add upon that is also always start. Because a lot of people don't even start. They don't even get out the gate. Start. And then once you start, finish. No matter what.
Initiative and follow through. Yep. Yeah, it's the yin and the yang that you have to make it birth.
And what is your three of your favorite films of all time?
Oh, man.
Can I assume the title of one of them?
You know, everyone assumes Raiders is my favorite film, but it's kind of transcended that by now.
Of course. For me. I mean, other than Spielberg and Michael Caine, whoever, I don't know who edited it. And Lucas, I think you're in the DNA of that film.
I can try filmmakers or movies.
Up to you. Yeah, movies. Try three movies. And then if you want to do three movies and three filmmakers, so that covers your bases.
I'll try movies. Peter Weir movie Witness with Harrison Ford.
Love that movie. Oh, love that movie.
It remains just perfect. Miller's Crossing by the Coen brothers.
Yes.
The Shining by Stanley Kubrick.
Not a bad trilogy.
Older, I know, but what can I say?
Well, I mean, The Shining. I mean, don't get me started on Kubrick. Are you kidding me? I'll just talk for hours and hours about that. Now, where can people find you and find out more about the movie? Get the movie. Get the book. Get everything you offer.
So, theraiderskids.com. is the website that that one can acquire a copy of a Blu-ray or DVD of the fan film itself. A lot of folks ask after seeing the documentary, how can I see the fan film? The documentary, by the way, screening on Hulu currently.
Nice.
And also Canopy for those at some public libraries and universities. But full disclosure, I'm told after seeing, you know, the documentary, you want to see the fan film. So yeah, the raiderskids.com, you can get the fan film, the documentary. Also, even Alan's fine book, which goes into, really tells the story in much greater depth than the documentary does, although the documentary guys did a great job. And even the storyboard book, those 602 storyboards that I did by memory.
Genius.
I published that as a reward to Kickstarter backers, and now I've got it available on the store. It includes photographs of my eyelashes and eyebrows coming out of, like, hairbrush bristles out of plaster, the police report of kids get his face stuck in plaster. Chris and I's correspondence through the years, you know, over the seven summers, and of course, the behind the scenes on how we did made a giant Jekyll statue of an old hot water heater, or how we did the special effects.
That's awesome.
So anyway, yeah, that's up on the website.
Eric, man, I first of all, I want to thank you for being on the show and telling your story, but man, I just got to say thank you for making this. It is a part of my childhood, and you did something that so many of us wanted to do, but you guys were crazy enough to do it and insane enough to do it in a very insane way on top of it. It's not like you shot for 30 days straight and finished it up. No. it took you years. Yeah, exactly. But it does show it's an example of passion and love of movies. And I think in the world that we live in today, so many times filmmakers get so caught up in you know, what's going to make me the next big thing, or what's going to get the attention of this guy or that agent and things. And you guys came at this from such a passionate place, where I think in today's cinema, there's a lot of lack of passion going on. So I appreciate you, man. I hope this story inspires a lot of filmmakers out there, not to go do a shot-by-shot recreation of Raiders of the Lost Ark, but to go out and make the film that they wanted to. Like Mr. Spielberg said, find a good story and tell it well. So my friend, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Alex, thank you.
I want to thank Eric for coming on the show and sharing his insane adventures with the tribe today. Thank you so much, Eric. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, the adaptation, or Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/491. And if you haven't already, guys, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, leave a good review, and subscribe. It really helps the show out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.